From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com. We are broadcasting from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studios. I'm Pim Fox, along with Lisa Abramowitz. Our guest now is Phil Orlando. He is the Chief Equity Market Strategist at Federated Investors. Thank you very much for being here, Phil. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me back. Happy New Year, belated.
Happy New Year to you. Are we in a trade war?
We've been in a trade war for a while. U.S.-China situation?
Yes.
But I don't know if trade war is the right word. Negotiation, skirmish. I mean, we think there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and we're hoping that light is not the headlight of an oncoming train. And we think over the course of the next 2 months, we're going to get some visibility on this.
How would an investor actually position a portfolio until they find out whether we're going to get an increase in tariffs, whether it's going to cost more to make products anywhere in the world?
That's a great question. So what we've got, in our opinion, has been this elaborate kabuki dance that's been going on for a while, you know, threatening tariffs and you know, this and that, in order to achieve the objective. Now, what is the objective? So you look at the situation from a financial standpoint. The United States is running a $600 billion balance of trade deficit against the world. And China, slightly more than $400 billion, is the largest offender. That's the reason why the administration, I think, has focused their attention on China. Now, what these discussions, negotiations, where we hope they end up by this March 1st deadline is twofold. Number one, China agrees to narrow that deficit, cut it in half, let's say to something in the $200 billion neighborhood, by buying more of our stuff that they need, agricultural products like soybean and corn, energy, aerospace and defense electronics, automobiles, things like that. The thornier issue here is the theft of intellectual property. And that's where I think this thing gets stickier. Now, our view is that this ends well, that the United States is under pressure, the Chinese economy and financial markets are under pressure, the leaders want to come to a deal. And so that's our base case. Now, part of the 20% correction that we saw in stocks over the last 4 months of the year was in part based upon the market's perception that this ends badly and that we're looking at a recession in the U.S., maybe a recession in China, maybe a global recession. But based upon our analysis, that's not the right conclusion. So we're actually pretty excited with the S&P at 2,300, you know, right around Christmas. We've had this nice 10% rally over the course of the last, you know, couple of weeks. We think we're running into some resistance here. We could absolutely, in our view, see a retest over the course of the next couple of months. But there are these three critical signposts in March, the trade thing with China being the first of them, the FOMC meeting in the middle of the month, and then the Brexit deadline at the end of the month. We think we get some clarity, some positive clarity in all three of those issues over the course of the month of March. So this volatility that we're seeing in the first quarter, we think leads to a much better environment in the back 9 months of the year. So we think the market's going to end up, you know, in pretty good shape. People look at our forecasts and say, you guys are lunatics. But, you know, look, if those three things fall into place, and we think they will, we think stocks are going to be a lot higher 12 months from now.
So let's talk specifics here, because we did just report that BlackRock is planning to cut 3% of its global workforce. It comes a day after State Street said that they were going to be cutting a significant portion of their workforce. We've seen financials on the asset management side as well as on the banking side really beaten up. Are you seeing value there?
You know, Lisa, I've been doing this now for 39 years, and I've noticed a trend that when the asset managers do these things, hires or fires, they usually do them at exactly the wrong time at the inflection point in the cycle. When they're hiring people, it's usually we're about to get a big blow off on a bull rally. And when they're firing people, it's usually at the bottom of the cycle and we're about to take off. Our best guess, based upon what we just talked about with the China question, is that stocks are going to be in a lot better shape 12 months from now than they are today. And if a couple of the big bellwethers are laying off a couple of percent of their workforce, that gives me greater confidence that we're at an inflection point, ready to go higher.
Although, in fairness, the asset management industry is facing a pretty fundamental shift toward passive management and toward reduced costs and a lot of other things that are causing them to want to reduce overhead.
Well, but that's an interesting point. And if we were to have this conversation 2 years ago, I would agree with you wholeheartedly. But if you look at the trends over the last couple of years, the active has actually been beating passive from a performance standpoint over the last couple of years, let's be honest. And we're starting to see that shift back over to active management in terms of asset flows versus passive, because investors are looking at their statements the last couple of years and saying, wait a second, all right, I'm paying 50 basis points less on fees, but I just gave up 500 basis points in relative performance. Maybe there's a place where both of these strategies can coexist.
Phil Orlando, you still have a 3,100 price target for the S&P 500?
12 months out. Yes, we do.
12 months out. Okay, so we're at 23, let's say 25 right now.
Well, you're right? Just under 2,600.
Yeah.
All right. We bottomed at 2,350 right around Christmas. What I'm telling you is we just rallied 10% up to what we think is a resistance level of 2,600. I think over the next 2 months, we could absolutely retrace that level. Let's call it back in that
2,300.
Yeah, I think we're going to retest 2,300 because of concern about Brexit and the Fed and China and the government shutdown and the stuff that Lisa just talked about with the layoffs and whatever. Is the labor market at risk? And then I think as we get through this first quarter, and in my opinion, get some positive clarity on some of these issues, then I think investors say, well, wait a second. We just contracted multiples from 18 times earnings to 14 times earnings because we thought the economy was about to roll in a recession. That's not happening. Inflation's 2%. Treasury yields are at 2.7%. We need to get multiples back to 18 times earnings. And that multiple expansion with a little bit of earnings gain, maybe 5 or 6% this year, is going to give us a nice rally in the last 9 months of the year.
So just in 30 seconds here, what were you buying with most conviction in the December sell-off?
I think energy and emerging markets are the things that look most interesting to us here over the last couple of weeks.
Energy stocks and emerging market stocks?
Yes.
In any particular nations?
No, I'm not that smart.
Come on, you don't give yourself enough credit, Phil. I love your insights. It's always wonderful speaking with you. And I like the bullishness. And honestly, there is a question, especially if President Trump really is using the stock market as a gauge of his success, that he will do everything that he wants to do and can do to keep it up. So there is that also tailwind that is potentially boosting markets as well.
Agreed.
Phil Orlando, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Phil Orlando is Chief Equity Market Strategist at Federated Investors. The minutes from the December Federal Reserve meeting indicated a willingness to wait, a sort of dovish tilt that has given some markets some confidence. Joining us now is Steve Blitz, Chief U.S. Economist for T.S. Lombard, and he joins us now by phone. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm just wondering, from your perspective, do you think that the Federal Reserve will hike rates again this year?
No, I don't. And first of all, Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year.
No, I don't think they're going to hike, because I think, you know, you always get this very interesting Fed speak, which has at the moment this notion that the asset markets are pricing one world and the economy is a different world, when we all know that asset prices determine economic activity. It's how monetary policy works. What has occurred to date, especially in terms of the curve in the fixed income markets and the treasury markets, will knock the average growth rate for the year below trend. So let's call it 1.5-2%. And in that environment, there is no reason why the Fed would increase rates.
Steve Blitz, do you believe that the Federal Reserve fully understands and concurs with the notion that economic growth is dependent, as well as the direction of asset prices is dependent on their monetary actions?
Well, it's a great question. The short answer to that question is obviously yes. Otherwise, what are they doing? But when you look at the minutes and they talk about what are the risks to growth, they put monetary policy about fourth. And first is what's happening in the global economy. And second is the shift from stimulus to a lack of stimulus, a drop off of the stimulus from the federal deficit. So those two factors in and of itself is number one and number two, and then they get into other things. So at the moment, they're seeing their policy is somewhat benign. I disagree with them, and I think the reason they see that is because they're looking at the level of nominal rates against growth in the economy, and they're saying, you know, money is still cheap, you know, 2.5% funds rate against 4-odd% nominal growth in GDP. But you have to look at it as an adjustment. You've gone from 10 years of zero rates to the money markets being a viable asset. And 10 years is a long time. There's a lot of habits, both on the borrowing and the investing side, that reflect zero rates. And last September, when the funds rate went over 2, and we know from behavioral finance, people don't react continuously. They react in discrete steps. And that discrete step was when we got a 2-handle on funds, and all of a sudden, as the old expression is, the dime dropped. And that would have to be an expression that people who haven't been in the market more than 10 years would know.
Well, let's talk about the balance sheet, because this is where the focus is turning, the $4 trillion of assets on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. What do you expect them to do with that? How much is that really affecting the sort of shrinking of it? How much is that actually affecting markets right now?
Well, I think there's two parts of that balance sheet that are up for discussion. Okay, so one, which was in the minutes, and I'm going to not dismiss this, but just put that aside because I don't think it's relevant for this discussion, which is the impact of shrinking the balance sheet and the internal plumbing of bank funding. It's an issue, and does the funds rate mean anything anymore, and all these things. But that's it's an issue. The contingency planning, it's important, but it's not important at the moment. And what's important at the moment is that the Fed is stepping away from buying 300 odd billion of treasuries this year, plus whatever the banks are pulling themselves out of the out of reserves and transferring it elsewhere, which means the Fed has to adjust their assets by selling, in effect, more treasuries, although they're not really selling, but in any event, let's just say selling to make it easier. At a time when you have a doubling of the deficit. And that means that the private markets have to not only accommodate and for what the Treasury is selling, but for what the Fed is not buying. And that's what has the markets a bit spooked. And if you notice, with the drop in yields in the term level, the term 7 to 10 year, even 5 to 10 year yields, the real yields haven't gone down that much. The inflation premiums dropped a lot. And the real yield has stayed up because you need to attract that capital to buy treasuries. So I think it means a lot. And I think that it was telling that when Powell was at the AEA last Friday, and we'll hear what he has to say today if he reiterates the comments or expands upon them, when he was for the first time, he said, look, if, and he said it in the context of treasury issuance, that in the context of treasury issuance, if they think that the Fed matters, that the Fed's balance sheet policies matter, they will adjust their policies. And I think that, and I know we have limited time, but I think that the first step the Fed's going to make is they're going to taper it, not end, but they're going to taper the pace of QT, and they'll get a nice, you know, PR benefit from that. And maybe they go in and instead of buying 7 to 10 year paper, maybe they buy some bills to try and get a little steepness back into the curve.
Thanks very much for being with us. Steve Blitz is chief economist at TS Lombard, speaking about the Federal Reserve and U.S. interest rates.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
The retail picture, not very nice today for investors. Macy's shares down about 18%. Matt Townsend joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studios. Matt is our global business reporter for Bloomberg News. And you can follow Matt on Twitter at Matt_Townsend. Okay, Matt_Townsend. Yes. I thought that the holiday shopping season was supposed to be gangbusters and everything was going to be right for the retail industry.
That's why this reaction is so, you know, steep. I mean, the story going into this was, yes, this is going to be a robust holiday season, maybe the best of the recovery. You know, last year was basically the best of the recovery to that point. So, you know, investors had this idea baked in that this is going to be a good holiday. Retailers will post good results. Results have been good throughout the year. Macy's comes out and says, our sales were weak. We're cutting our earnings guidance. And the whole market sells off. So investors are just pouring out of retail stocks at this point.
So what I'm wondering is, are investors overreacting to an idiosyncratic issue with Macy's, considering the fact that the guidance wasn't that bad for Target, and Bed Bath and Beyond even guided upward, and investors basically are saying, we don't believe you.
Yeah, that's the question. Is this a department store issue? Kohl's, another department store, had an underwhelming report on their holiday sales. You know, the thing about Target, which some of the analysts were calling out, was yes, they had this 5% growth, but they didn't raise their guidance for the fourth quarter. They didn't say anything about profits. So, you know, every holiday there's this big battle between, do you go after sales or do you protect profit? So if you go after sales but hurt your profit, investors are going to hit you there. If you don't hit on sales, they're going to hit you there. So yes, this is raising red flags in the investment community that maybe the holiday isn't as good as expected, and consumers maybe are ready to pull back on their spending potentially.
Well, if you look at all of the websites of these major retailers, they are all offering discounts and sales of up to 20%. That kind of matches the decline in the stock of Macy's today.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Macy's is offering an extra 20% off, an extra 15% off. I mean, if they've trained the customer to wait for sales and to wait until prices are cut, what hope do they have of maintaining those margins?
Right. That's one of the things we were talking about this morning is shoppers are so savvy now. They know all the prices. They know all the promotions. And they basically
do know how to use mobile phones. I've heard that they know how to compare and contrast. Yeah.
So you're right.
A
lot of shoppers do wait till the end for discounts or sales. They're very savvy. You know, but just back to department stores, you know, one of the things, if people are shifting from their purchases from department stores to, say, a Target, you know, we don't know what Walmart did yet. So maybe Walmart did well. You know, that's also a potential sort of negative sign for the economy. If they're the trading down effect, if shoppers are going from a department store shopper to a discount shopper.
So can you just give us some perspective here? Have we heard enough to know that, yes, Macy's will be a bellwether for retailers in the first quarter?
We have not. When the dust settles, when all these companies report their fourth quarter earnings, which won't be till February because their quarters run through January, that's when we'll really know. And so this could just be You know, Macy's and Kohl's did not have good holidays, but Best Buy, Walmart did really well. Some of these other chains, obviously, there's Amazon. We know they obviously are a big holiday player. So, you know, we'll see. The story is not written at this point.
Taking a look at Costco, for example, Costco wholesale, same store sales in December up 7.5%. That was the same store sales for the total company. That was U.S. stores. So the total company up 6%. Stock is basically unchanged. So maybe they got it right and Macy's got it wrong.
Right. Again, Costco, a discount play. You know, that's what we saw in the last recession. Was, you know, there was this sort of deterioration among the sort of middle income retailers. And then, you know, consumers a little more worried about their finances, shifting down to the discounters, dollar stores, things like that.
I think what it does do is it casts some high skepticism on all the claims about how the holiday season was fantastic. And I think that that perhaps is the big takeaway. So a little bit more caution heading into the earnings season.
40 to 50% off all coats at Macy's. And I believe if you're, you know, going to rush out, Matt Townsend, 50 to 85% off for menswear.
Well, good to know. Matt Townsend, we'll let you go off and shop because that's what you do at your desk all day, I'm sure. Not at all. He is a very hardworking reporter. Matt Townsend for Bloomberg News joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studios.
Crude oil today falling after a string of increases. The value of crude on the NYMEX, $52.13 for a barrel of crude. That's a decline of about 0.5%. Here to help us understand what's going on in the world of fossil fuel, Stephen Schork. He is the president of the Schork Group. Stephen, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. What do you think the price of oil is going to be at the end of the month? Are we staying around $50, $52 a barrel?
Yes, I don't see, Pim, us going significantly higher. Perhaps we can make a foray into the mid-50s. Keep in mind that we had a significant sell-off at the end of 2018 where spot prices got down to about $42. So we're a solid $10 a barrel higher. We're pretty much now at the bottom of the market. That is to say, I think that $42 number was overdone. You had a significant amount of psychological factors pushing all markets lower, and I think crude oil just fell in sympathy with everything else. So the market obviously got way too low at 42. At 52.55, when we look at the economics of pulling a barrel out of the oil, generally in here in North America, you're essentially at the bottom. The concern now going forward, why we'll probably see a cap on prices for at least the next 2 months, Pim, is that demand for crude oil now is strong, but in the months ahead, and certainly by the end of the first quarter, demand will be significantly lower because refineries here in North America and Northern Europe will go into their maintenance season, so they'll begin buying fewer barrels on the spot market of crude oil, which should lead to some overhang going into the second quarter.
I'm just wondering, why have analysts gotten oil so wrong? What is the big variable that people keep underestimating with oil?
With oil, right. That's an excellent question, Lisa. And I think certainly with regard to oil, it's similar to what a natural gas, where we tend to look solely on the supply side. So I think at this point, we put too much weight on the impact of OPEC. Part of the run-up that we saw back in September, we keep in mind that we had about a $10 rally in September, which is at the weakest demand part of the month, on speculation of what the pending Iran sanctions, which went into effect on November 1st, were going to impact the market. So we're always looking at the supply side, and we tend to ignore the demand side. And I think gauging demand, whether it's in oil, natural gas, that is really the art to forecasting right now. And similar to natural gas, where I think too many forecasts took into consideration record production and completely ignored the fact that demand was keeping pace with that production.
Do you believe that Saudi production will remain at its current level?
I do. I think it will have to, if not, they will have to put more barrels on the market. The U.S. Perhaps now is producing as much as 12 million barrels a day, which is by far the largest producer in the world. I do not expect to see any sort of significant pullback in that production, even down at these levels, given that last summer production for 2019, you had the ability for at least 2 months to hedge at $70-$75 a barrel. So I do believe we have a significant amount of future production that's already been sold at these levels. So those producers will have to continue to produce to offset those short positions in the future market. So Saudi really cannot up production. I think at a minimum, they will maintain production, if not have to pull production out of the market, given the strong response by U.S. producers.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. You're talking about how people are overestimating OPEC. I'm wondering, what's the perfect price for U.S. producers?
U.S. producer right now, keep in mind in 2014, when everyone was under the assumption at the end of that year that Saudi Arabia was trying to derail North American production. I said it then and I've said it ever since, and I'll continue to say it. Saudi was not trying to destroy U.S. production because they couldn't destroy U.S. or Canadian production. So that said, what Saudi Arabia actually did in 2015 was give the industry a shot in the arm and did all the heavy lifting that the Fed's cheap capital created that bubble. So now what I'm getting out here is that U.S. producers are much more profitable at lower levels, given the efficiencies they've created over the last 3 years. So at a minimum, depending on the play, you can make money with oil as low as $25 a barrel, $35 a barrel. But if you're going to take a blended price, I would think to say that we are at these levels, looking at my Bloomberg at oil right around $52 a barrel, we're pretty much at the bottom of the market. You would want to see oil back to where we saw it back in September, up around that $65-$75 level, and that would certainly be a sweet spot for U.S. producers.
Stephen Schork, in about 20 seconds, do you believe that the gasoline shortage in Mexico is going to have any effect on the price of oil?
No, I don't. Actually, Pim, at this point, I don't think the Mexican shortage at this point will have much of an impact, especially given that gasoline supplies here in the United States are at an all-time high, and that will continue through the first quarter.
Thank you so much for being with us. Oil, definitely an important topic right now because it's also been a driver in inflation expectations. As we've seen oil rebound, so too have five-year inflation expectations, which have had their best four-day rally in a very long time. Stephen Schork, thank you so much for being with us, president of the Schork Group.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.